Gulf Coast State College, Anatomy and Physiology, The Nervous System, Part 2. Well, in the last section, we studied in great detail this big old funky cell down here called the neuron. So I hope already you know all the pieces and parts like the back of your hand. Because to understand neurophysiology, it's a given that you know all those pieces and parts. The term neurophysiology doesn't sound easy, and it's not. This is not one of those things where you're going to go home after hearing it only one time and say, "Oh, Uncle Bob, I'm going to tell you everything you need to know about neurophysiology." If you were like me, when I was your age, I had to go home and do it like six times. And then I still had a few kind of points that were missing. So anyway, work on this. And if you have any points where you're not connecting the dots, so to speak, you get in touch with me. So let's go ahead and talk about this wonderful ability of the neuron to be able to produce electrical signals. In general, only two cells in the body we talk about in A and P that can conduct electricity or produce electrical signals, I should say, a muscle cell and a nerve cell. And here we're going to talk about the nerve cell called the neuron. How can this special cell produce electrical signals? It has two special things going for it that allow it to have this special property. Number one, it has something called a resting membrane potential. When you hear that term, I just want you to think voltage, because you're familiar with voltage of batteries and that sort of thing. So to make it simple, just think voltage. If we really break it down, though, it means as this neuron is at rest, just sitting there in an undisturbed state, in the cell membrane that surrounds the whole funky-shaped cell, there is a potential energy there stored as a voltage, kind of like a battery. You look at a battery, and it has a positive terminal, a negative terminal, and there's a voltage stamped on the battery. Maybe it's 1.5 volts or 9 volts or whatever. The other thing that a neuron has going for it that allows it to conduct electrical signals is it has something called ion channels. We'll see that these are like protein pores studded in the surface of the cell membrane that allow electricity, or more properly, ions, to flow through and along the cell membrane of the neuron. Think of it this way, by the way. You have a battery. As it just sits there, there's an energy, a potential energy, a voltage stored in there. But is energy or electricity flowing as it's just sitting there? And the answer is no. You have to hook the two poles of the battery together, maybe with a wire that goes to a lamp, and then the wire comes back to the other pole, and the light bulb comes on. Well, we don't have that set up in a neuron. We have ion channels. The ion channels would be sort of analogous to the wire. So the ion channels are what lets the voltage flow along and through the cell membrane of a neuron. Let's define these things a little bit better. What is the resting membrane potential? How does it actually happen? Down below, have a diagram. Here is your old friend, the cell membrane, notice the phospholipid bilayer. Of course, now this is going to be the cell membrane of a neuron. I have labeled in pale blue, we have the extracellular fluid compartment. And in sort of a light or pastel yellow or tan, we have the intracellular fluid compartment. And please recall, when we did fluid and electrolytes, we had to know which ions were mostly extracellular and which ones were mostly intracellular. And here it comes back to help us. Remember, we had the NBCs, including sodium chloride outside, and the PPPs shown right here on the inside. Well, here's where it comes to help us, because it just so turns out that positive charges like sodium tend to line up and accumulate on the outside of the nerve cell membrane in the extracellular fluid. And I made a little moving arrow animation to highlight that. There they are. And it just so turns out that negative charges and ions tend to accumulate close to the inside surface of the neuron cell membrane in the intracellular fluid. So there's a moving red arrow to show you those lining up. Therefore, the membrane is positive on the outside and negative on the inside. The term for that is polarized. Again, please think of a battery. Here I took some clip art and I took a battery and lined up the positive pole and the negative pole and sized it up just right so it would match the positive outside and negative inside of our neuron cell membrane. And just like a battery has a voltage in it, the neuron cell membrane has a stored voltage in it. Remember, that's called the resting membrane potential. And this is a number I do want you to know. The average neuron resting membrane potential is minus 70 millivolts. I know that's a negative number. A lot of us, including myself, don't like to work with negative numbers. But the person who defined this from the beginning, the way they did it was, they stuck a needle through the cell membrane and punched it inside. And then they had the meter out here. And since the inside is negative with respect to the outside, that's how they came up with the negative number. Could they have done it a different way? Yeah, but they didn't, so we have to deal with minus 70 millivolts. Again, there's my moving green arrow to remind you, positive lines up outside, negative lines up on the inside. Okay, so we are done defining the resting membrane potential, or the voltage, in the cell membrane. Now let's talk about what allows that electricity to flow through and along and across the cell membrane. And it happens through the use of something called ion channels. There are two types of ion channels. One are called leakage channels. And guess what they do? They leak just randomly, willy-nilly. They open and close. I got nothing more to say about them. Know that they exist, but they're really not pertinent for the rest of our discussion. The ones you got to know about are the gated channels. They're called gated channels because they have gates, and the gates will open and close in response to some stimulus. So as a visual down below here, I have a cell membrane. Let's assume, of course, this is the neuron cell membrane. There are proteins studding that membrane. This is actually from an earlier chapter in the book. Here's a protein pore that goes all the way through the cell membrane. It has a channel through it, and it's got a little plug or a little gate on it. This is an example of what a gated channel would look like physically. Also notice what I did here. Put up a battery. There's a 9-volt job. Positive terminal. Yep, I lined it up good. Negative terminal. Lined it up to match the nerve cell membrane, just nice and pretty. Reminds me of a true story. You know that battery, as it's sitting there, there's no electricity flowing. Got to hook the terminal together. How did me and my brother do it when we were little? That's right, we stuck our tongue across those two terminals and the electricity was flowing. Now, do not do that. Do not do anything I say to do in the course. Just learn the material. The point is, for a nerve cell membrane, the way we get electricity flow on, or more properly, ions flowing, is through gated ion channels. Let's take a look at them. There are three types of gated ion channels, and the name tells you what opens the gate. I love anatomy because the name often gives the whole thing away. There are voltage-gated channels, and voltage is what's going to pop open the gate. There are ligand, or what I used to call chemical gated channels, and those are channels where chemicals will open the gates. Finally, there are mechanically gated channels, and those are gated ion channels, which will pop open in response to some kind of mechanical stimulus. I show it in more detail on the next three slides, but there's really no new information. Here's an example. Once again, neuron cell membrane down here to your left. There's a protein pore. That's a gated ion channel. As the neuron sits at rest, it's comfortable and happy at minus 70 millivolts. Let's say something comes along and changes the voltage. And in this example, we change the voltage to minus 50. Minus 50 is different than minus 70. And if I'm a voltage-gated ion channel, I am genetically predetermined and designed to pop open if I detect a change in voltage. So, shown in this example, if you change the voltage, a voltage-gated channel pops open and lets some ion flow through it. Don't focus on this slide on which ion is flowing which direction, because different ions could flow different ways. Now comes the ligand or chemical gated channels. Yes, they open and close in response to some specific chemical stimulus. You should know some common examples will include neurotransmitters and hormones. So here's the visual. Neuron cell membrane. Here's a protein chemical gated channel. Initially, the channel is closed shut, but then here comes some chemical that looks like a red ruby. The red ruby binds to a chemical receptor on the chemical gated channel, and when it does, it pops open the gate, and some ions can then flow through. Finally, mechanical gated channel. Open and close in response to some mechanical stimulus. You vibrate it, you touch it, you pull it, you stretch it, you tug it. Examples: touch receptors in skin, stretch receptors in the walls of the gastrointestinal tract. And one you might want to circle: hearing and balance. A lot of people tend to forget that those are mechanically regulated type of senses. And if you don't believe me, you could stick your head next to a big bass speaker and you can feel that mechanical pressure. Of course, don't do that. I'm just saying that's an example. Let's look at the visual. Once again, we got a neuron cell membrane. We got a yellow protein ion channel with the gate in it. Some mechanical stimulus comes along. I push it, I tug it, I pull it, stretch it, vibrate it. That channel was genetically designed and predetermined to pop open in response to that stimulus. And over here, it shows the gate pops open and some ion flows through. Now we get to the nitty-gritty. Now we're diving into some details. Electrical signals in neurons. There are two different types of electrical signals. We'll talk about them at great length and in great detail. The first kind are called graded potentials. The second kind are called action potentials, which are also termed nerve impulses. You should know that an action potential is exactly the same thing as a nerve impulse. They are synonyms, and they are used interchangeably in the real world and on tests, for example. On the following slides, yeah, we're going to really dive in here deep, and the where, what, why, and how of these two different signals are going to be described, even though we study them in compartments, because it's easy to study them in little segments or nuggets. You should understand that although they have many differences, they often occur together. So here we go. First comes graded potentials. Here's the where, what, why, and how. Graded potentials, this type of voltage, only occurs in dendrites and the cell body. So I have highlighted in our picture of the neuron with blue arrows the blue cell body and dendrites. That's where this type of voltage occurs. How does it occur? Only through the use of ligand, that means chemical, and mechanically gated channels. Only chemical and mechanically gated channels are flowing ions here in the cell body and dendrites. What are they? They are small, local, variable changes in the resting membrane potential caused by some stimulus. Let's bust that down. Small means small. That means these are not high voltage changes. They just go a little bit one way or a little bit the other way, but not very big. Local means local. It means they don't travel very far. These voltage changes just sort of slowly meander around the blue cell body and dendrites in your diagram. Variable means variable. I defined it down below just in case you don't know what that means. It means some stimulus might come along that might make the inside of the nerve cell membrane either a little more negative or a little more positive than the resting membrane voltage. There are two types of graded potentials we'll look at. One is called hyperpolarizing, one is called depolarizing. And please don't forget, we're talking about voltage changes here. And that's why I put an expanding red oval around the cell body and dendrites. No better way to explain this than through examples, because this is one of the hardest concepts in neurophysiology for students to grasp. So here we go. My first example is like this. I have a neuron up top here with the cell body and dendrites highlighted. Let's say some chemical stimulus comes along and causes ions to flow through channels in the cell membrane so that the inside of the cell membrane becomes polarized more negative than the resting potential. Example shown here, a little graph. Here is the negative 70 millivolt resting potential where the neuron sits in an undisturbed state. Something comes along, makes the inside more negative, shown by this red downward curve. In this example, let's say it dipped down to minus 75. There's a name for that. That's called a hyperpolarizing graded potential. Let's break that down. Polarized. Remember, as a neuron, we're polarized, right? And we're polarized a little bit negative. At rest, we're polarized at minus 70. I want you to be the neuron, and you're going to have to be a little bit bummed out. You're going to have to be a little bit depressed, because as you hang out at rest, you're a little negative. You're minus 70. What does hyper mean? Hyper means more. So if you put hyperpolarized together, that means hypernegative. So hyperpolarizing means more negative. In this situation, I want you to think of the cell membrane of the neuron as being less excited. You bummed it out. You depressed it. You made it more negative. That's why I drew a little sad face, or put a little clip art sad face on your slide. Let's see if you really understand this. So I'm going to give some examples. And the key is be the neuron. So right now I'm going to be the neuron. I'm pretending my body with my arms and legs hanging out are the cell body and the dendrites. Which way would I have to move negative ions across my skin or across my cell membrane to hyperpolarize myself, to make myself more negative inside? Answer, I would have to move them inside me. That's one way to hyperpolarize me. Move negative ions like chloride into me. If I do that, I made myself more negative, more depressed, less excited. I'm hypernegative, hyperpolarized. Here comes another example. Could be a good test question. Which way would I have to move any positive ion, any cation like sodium or calcium, across my cell membrane, across my skin, to hyperpolarize me? Would I have to move the positive ion into me or take it out of me? And the correct answer, of course, is take it out of me. If I take positive ion, any cation out of me, I will make myself more negative. I will make myself more depressed, less excited. So that's another way to hyperpolarize a neuron, by taking the positive out of the neuron. So be the neuron. Start out a little bit depressed. If you want to be hyperpolarized, there's two ways to make you more depressed. You could either put more negative in you, more negativity, more negative thoughts, or you could take the positive thoughts out of you, take the positivity out of you. That's another way to make yourself more depressed, right? So be the neuron. That's the key. Let's do another example. Let's say some mechanical stimulus comes along here. I push or pull or tug on the cell body and dendrites such that ions flow through channels in the cell membrane so that the inside of the cell membrane becomes more positive than the resting membrane potential. Shown down here on the green graph, starting at minus 70, but then something comes along and makes the voltage change more positive, let's say to minus 60. And minus 60 is more positive than minus 70, right? The term for that is a depolarizing graded potential. Let's break it down again. Polarized means I'm polarized a little bit negative. I start out a little bit bummed out and depressed. What does the root word D mean? D means to undo something. If you destabilize a country, you've undone the stability of the country. If I depolarize the cell body and the dendrites, I've undone their negativity. I would like you please to think of the cell membrane, in this case, as being more excited. That's why I put a clip art happy face on the paper. Okay, so now here comes some great questions to see if you really understand this. Which way would I have to move any positive ion, doesn't matter what I pick on the test, to depolarize me? Would I have to move it inside of me or take it out of me? Correct answer is I would have to put it inside me. If I take positive sodium cation and flow it into me, into my body, through my skin, I've made myself more positive. I'm more happy. I'm more excited. I'm less depressed. I've undone my negativity. Likewise, which way would I have to move any ion on the test, like chloride, to depolarize me? Would I have to put chloride in me or take it out of me? I think you're catching on. The correct answer is I would have to take the chloride out of me. That's another way to depolarize me. Another way to undo my negativity is by taking the negative out of me. If I take the negativity or the negative thoughts out of me, I'm more happy, I'm more excited, I'm less depressed, I've undone my negativity, I'm depolarized. Be the neuron. Here's one of those embedded animations from your text. Check them out. I hope they're working for you. The second type of electrical signal we see in a neuron is called an action potential. This is the slide that shows sort of in summary the where, what, why, and how. Notice it's going to be very different than the graded potentials. An action potential is an all or none. That means it happens or it doesn't happen. It's like you're pregnant or you're not pregnant. Large. Large means large. These are high voltage, high tension, electrical lightning bolt spikes. Rapid. Rapid means fast, and I mean up to 300 miles an hour fast. One-way nerve impulse that travels along the cell membrane of the axon. Remember, the axon is where the action is. How does it happen? Only through the use of voltage-gated channels. When I think action potential, I think axon, I think high voltage, high tension, electrical lightning bolts. So with that, it's easy for me to remember that action potentials only use the high voltage-gated channels. look at this last bullet point. An action potential will occur if a graded potential depolarizes the cell membrane to threshold at the trigger zone. Uh-oh, that's a lot of stuff packed into one statement. I got it all highlighted and bolded, so yeah, you know it's important, you gotta know it. Let's break it down one at a time. You can figure this out. What is that really saying in English? It says an action potential will pop off if what? A graded potential. Well, what's that? All that means is voltage changes here on the blue dendrites and cell body. So an action potential will occur if voltage changes here, depolarize. What does that mean? That means becomes more positive. So an action potential will occur if we excite the cell membrane of the cell body and dendrites enough to reach some magic limit called the threshold. Don't worry about what that number is. It's on another slide, but it's a more positive number. And if you reach that threshold, if you reach that limit, at the point on the cell membrane you should already know called the trigger zone that I'm trying to touch on with my pointer, then you will pop off this large, rapid, one-way lightning bolt down the cell membrane of the axon. Here's my little visual. What I did was I took some clip art. This is an electric eel. I took the electric eel, I sized it up and stretched it out, made it match the neuron just as I wanted to. I have the head of the eel kind of matching the head of the neuron. The head of the eel represents the cell body and the dendrites. The tail of the eel represents the axon. Because I know this is a difficult concept, and I try to come up with a way in sort of plain English to make this all sink in better. So I use this electric eel example. I never seen anybody use this before, by the way. So if you see it, that means somebody stole it from me. So here we go. Let's do this one more time. Let's say here's an electric eel. And you go ahead and you dump some chemical like some acid on his head. Or you start poking him in the head with your harpoon. If you just poke him or irritate him a little bit, he's going to get a little bit excited, right? In other words, you're going to depolarize him there a little bit. But if you leave him alone after that, he might leave you alone. But let's say you decide you're going to keep poking him and poking him and poking him in the head with your mechanical stimulus or keep dumping more acid on his head. That would be a chemical stimulus. Eventually, he's going to reach his limit. He's going to say, I had enough. And you know what I mean when I see reach your limit or reach your threshold. Especially if you have kids, you know what I mean about reaching your limit. I mean, if you finally excite him enough, depolarize him enough, so that he reaches his limit at the trigger zone, which I'm going to say is the back of his neck, the hairs on the back of his neck are going to stand up because he's so excited. And he's going to say, I had enough. You know, you've excited me enough. I'm done with you. I am going to then shoot off a lightning bolt down my tail. That will be the action potential. And I'm going to zap you. I've also animated this on PowerPoint. So again, if we depolarize the cell membrane enough to reach the limit called threshold at the point on the cell membrane called the trigger zone, we will pop off this boom lightning bolt action potential down the axon. Well, we have to know a little bit more than that. So this is some nitty gritty. I know the slide looks busy, maybe trivial to you, but I'm going to boil it down to the things you have to know from my course. To the upper left, here's our neuron. What did we just do? Boom, we shot that action potential down the axon. What does it look like ultrastructurally? What does it look like bioelectrochemically, so to speak, if you could actually get in there and see it happening? And I envision it this way. If you could stick a needle right into that action potential as it's passing by, and then that needle, let's say, is hooked up to a volt gauge, what would that look like? Another way to envision it is picture a lightning bolt, you know, coming down from the sky to the ground. Let's say you wanted to measure that. Don't do this either, by the way. Stick a needle into it with a voltage meter on the end. What would that voltage meter read? What would it look like as the action potential passed the tip of your needle? That's the idea. So here we go. Let's go down the graph. As the neuron is sitting in its resting state, it's hanging out a little depressed at minus 70. Then some stimulus comes along that depolarizes, excites the cell membrane enough to reach some magic number, we're just calling the threshold, then pops off the lightning bolt. And the lightning bolt has two phases you need to know. The big positive upward green spike, that's called the depolarization phase. That is followed by the big red downward drop called the repolarization phase. You must also know what causes that, if I ask you. During the depolarization phase, sodium rushes in rapidly. If I rushed a whole bunch of sodium inside me, if I was, you know, the axon cell membrane, and I rushed a whole bunch of sodium inside me, won't that massively depolarize me? Of course it would, because I put a whole bunch of positive in me real fast. What about the repolarization phase? If I ask you what causes the big red downward drop back down to minus 70, by the way, you will tell me potassium flows out. Won't that repolarize me? Won't that bring me back and reset me back to minus 70? If I take positive potassium out of me, that will bring me back down to minus 70. Remember, that's another way to bring us back to negative, is to take positive ions out. So that's what explains the two phases of an action potential. I like to use another example because these are difficult concepts. So I used clip art again, and I took a picture of an old-fashioned flash camera. Most of you probably don't remember these. Had the old flash cubes on the top. And I think of it this way. When I click the flash camera, when I press the button and the flash goes off, that lightning bolt, that flash, that's the depolarization phase of the action potential. And then, those of you who've been around long enough know that right after the flash, you heard this whine. It kind of went like, well, that was the resetting phase. That was the repolarization phase. And it's really good to think of the repolarization phase as the resetting phase, just like in a flash camera. Because if that flash camera didn't reset itself, no matter how many times you push the button, you couldn't flash off another flash out of the flash cube. Same thing with an action potential in the human body. If you don't reset it back to minus 70, the axon could never fire off another action potential again. You must reset it. This next slide from your book looks very busy. I don't like this slide, to tell you the truth. If you don't like it, you can crumple it up and throw it out. There's no new information here. Basically, all I said is, as far as the nitty-gritty, here's what you got to know. Two phases of an action potential. Number one, there goes a green box around the depolarizing phase where sodium rushes in. Then comes phase number two with a red expanding circle around it, the repolarizing phase where potassium flows out. And that's what you have to know in a nutshell. Here's another embedded animation that hopefully will help you in some way. Now that we looked in detail at these electrical signals, we have to figure out and we have to know why that action potential gets down the wire. It's called propagation of nerve impulses. In English, how does the action potential get all the way down the wire from point A to point B? How does the action potential conduct along the cell membrane from the trigger zone to the axon terminals? There's two possible ways. One is called continuous conduction, and one is called saltatory conduction. So I have another little animation here on PowerPoint. Here comes, boom, an action potential, a bright red arrow slamming down the wire. How does it get down the wire? Because we gotta go places with this electricity. First way is continuous conduction. A figure from your book, not so thrilled about overall. Don't tell anybody I'm saying that. But off to your left here, this is trying to show you a neuron undergoing an example of continuous conduction. Bullet points you got to know. Number one, it occurs in unmyelinated axons. And in this type of conduction, action potentials pass along the entire length of the axon step by step as ions flow through adjacent voltage-gated ion channels. Here's the picture from your book showing cell body and dendrites. There's the axon. Here's the first voltage-gated ion channel for sodium shown as a green rectangle at the trigger zone. Remember, if we excite the head of the eel, if we depolarize that cell membrane enough to reach threshold at the trigger zone, that voltage-gated ion channel for sodium was designed to pop open. Usually in class, what I do is I kind of pretend I'm the neuron again. I stand in front of the class, and I pretend my body is that green rectangle at the trigger zone, and I pretend the cell body and dendrites are kind of behind me. And, of course, I just said there's a change in voltage in the cell body behind me. And my job as a voltage-gated ion channel, if I feel a change in voltage, is to do what? Is to pop open. So I sense a change in voltage behind me. I pop open. I let sodium flow through. If I let sodium flow through at that point in the cell membrane, don't I change the voltage at that point? Of course I do. I just flowed a whole bunch of sodium in. Then you have to imagine there's another green rectangle right next to that, another voltage-gated ion channel for sodium. That, again, I picture myself standing at that next point, and I just sense behind me a change in voltage, and my job as a voltage-gated channel is to pop open. So now I pop open, and I let sodium through, and I, therefore, cause a change in voltage at that given point, and it goes on and on and on. The next voltage gate pops open, and the next one is like a series of dominoes. One gate opens, and that changes the voltage, which opens another gate, and on she goes. I think of it like dominoes, and I remember actually slow dominoes, because this is a slow type of conduction. As slow as 1 mile an hour. Very different from the next type of conduction we call saltatory conduction. The root word saltatory does mean to leap, if you like your Greek root words, and it does appear to leap or jump down the wire. The picture off to your right from your book is just so-so, but I'll try to explain it shortly. Bullet points you must know. This type of conduction occurs in myelinated axons. And the good news is most axons in the human body have myelin, about 80% of them, I think is the figure your book gives. In this type of conduction, the action potential passes along the axon from one node of Ron VA, to the next. And what is critical to know is there are high concentrations of voltage-gated ion channels at those nodes. And again, the impulse will appear to leap very fast or jump or skip from one node of Ranvier to another. This is a very fast type of conduction, up to about 300 miles an hour. How does it work? Well, here's a picture again, cell body and dendrites. Here's a green rectangular voltage-gated ion channel. But what I really want you to picture instead of this is not just one channel there. Picture like a whole pack of them, like say 12. Let's say there's 12 voltage-gated ion channels for sodium there. And I stand there and I feel the depolarization to threshold behind me. And now I'm a whole pack of 12 of these puppies. And when I feel that change in voltage behind me, what's my job? What do? I pop open. 12 of me at once pop open. And I massively rush in a whole mess of sodium. And I massively change the voltage so much at that point, it creates what you could think of like a spark. And that spark is so powerful, it jumps to the next node of Ranvier, where again there's a whole pack, like 12, let's say, for example, 12 voltage-gated ion channels. They sense the change in voltage. Their job is to open. They pop open all at once. They rush a mess of sodium in, and on it goes from one node of Ranvier to the next, jumping down the wire rapidly. The way I remember saltatory conduction is like packs of firecrackers. I don't know if you ever did this, and I'm not suggesting to do it, and it might not even be, it's probably not even legal to do it in Florida, but you may have heard of this, let's say. If you ever lit off like a pack of firecrackers, and then there was another pack of firecrackers maybe a couple feet away, the pack of firecrackers that you lit off first can make such big sparks that the sparks can jump over to the next pack of firecrackers a couple feet away and light them off too, even though you didn't want to. So that's how I think of saltatory conduction, like packs of firecrackers. Some of you are probably thinking, well, now he's really getting trivial. I'll never see this again in my whole life, but I'll memorize it and understand it for the test. Well, here's how it's actually applied. You've heard of people getting numbing injections, right? Like lidocaine, numbing medicine. How does lidocaine work? Lidocaine works by basically paralyzing these sodium voltage-gated ion channels on the axons. So therefore, guess what? You can't conduct any electricity down the axons, so your pain signals cannot get to your brain. What about ice? Mama says put ice on, you know, the bump, it won't hurt as bad. Why was she right? She was right because ice works by slowing down these voltage-gated ion channels. And so you perceive less pain by the time it reaches your brain because the ice has slowed this process down. What about TTX? I love TTX. You don't have to know exactly what it is. TTX is tetrodotoxin. Just for fun, it comes from a pufferfish. How can an improperly prepared pufferfish kill you? Because this toxin, what it does is it paralyzes the voltage-gated ion channels on our axons. So we can't conduct electricity, including to our diaphragm. Therefore, we stop breathing. So yes, this is real stuff. Well, all we did so far was get electricity down one neuron, but our nervous system is way more complicated than that. For example, in your brain, about 100 billion neurons, and they make connections with other neurons. Your book, I think, says the average number of connections or synapses per nerve cell in the central nervous system is between 1,000 and 10,000. Can you imagine 100 billion brain cells making 10,000 connections with other cells? That's like trillions of connections. So we have to have a way to communicate between two neurons and more. And the way we do that is through something called a chemical synapse. A chemical synapse is a junction between neurons. An example of a common location I'll point out here is between, let's say, the axon of this neuron and the dendrite of the next neuron in this chain. That's a common type of connection. We're going to look at that in great detail. What I did on this slide on the bottom is took two neurons, blew them up really big, and put them together in this connection that we're going to study called the synapse. Your book doesn't have a picture like this, and I think it really is a huge missing link from your text. So I hope you really appreciate the value of this picture that I have for you down here. So, here's one neuron, here's another neuron. Here's the junction. The junction or communication site is called a chemical synapse. Let me ask you a question. Is this connection a direct physical connection? Are these two neurons directly, physically, tightly plugged into one another? And the answer is no. There is a gap. There is a space between the two neurons. And those of you who looked ahead, which I hope is everyone, know that that space is called the synaptic cleft. So I will put a red expanding oval around the chemical synapse, which includes the space called the cleft. And the problem our nervous system has to overcome is this. Electricity cannot jump the gap. It's not like in one of those stores in the mall where they have this thing. It's like a clear plastic ball, and inside there's a metal rod. And if you put your hand on the plastic ball, the purple electricity jumps from the metal rod up to your hand that's on the plastic ball. I mean, I've never been in that store. I just seen that thing. But that doesn't happen in the nervous system. Electricity doesn't jump the gap between two neurons. So we have to have a special way to do it. Here's the short story. This first neuron in the chain that's before the synapse is called the presynaptic neuron. The second neuron in the chain after the synapse is called the postsynaptic neuron. I may affectionately refer to them as neuron number one and neuron number two because I don't feel like saying presynaptic neuron and postsynaptic neuron 10,000 times. So here's the deal. The presynaptic neuron has the job of changing an electrical signal into a chemical signal. That chemical can then drift across the cleft, land on neuron number two, and then the postsynaptic neuron has the job of changing the chemical signal it received back into an electrical signal. Let's take a look at how that really happens. I know this picture looks overwhelming. Seven steps of the chemical synapse. I made my seven numbers match the seven blue bubbles on the figure that I've used. If you've already done muscle physiology, half of this is actually an old story. If you look back at muscle physiology, I'm telling you, half of this you already sort of kind of know. So it's not that bad. Let's break it down one at a time. I'll do this once with you. On this slide with the words, then I'm going to go to another slide with no words, and you're going to do it with me, or maybe by yourself. So here we go. Step number one, a nerve impulse, also called an action potential, reaches the synaptic end bulb of the presynaptic neuron. Then, step number two, that voltage lands on a voltage-gated ion channel, which of course pops open in response to the change in voltage, which allows, in this case, calcium to flow into the synaptic end bulb. That leads to step number three. Calcium is a signal which causes exocytosis of neurotransmitter. In other words, when calcium flows into a synaptic end bulb, that is a signal for these little red packets, these vesicles that contain chemicals called neurotransmitters, to become released, to be spit out by that process we know called exocytosis. And the neurotransmitter gets spit out into the space called the synaptic cleft. That leads to step number four. The neurotransmitter binds to receptors on chemical or ligand-gated channels. That's right, the neurotransmitter is a chemical that lands on a chemical-gated ion channel on the postsynaptic neuron's cell membrane. That will lead to step number five. The chemical will pop open the chemical gate and allow ions, in this case positive sodium, to flow across the postsynaptic neuron cell membrane, which will, of course, change its voltage, right? With a star on it. I mean, if I flow any ion across this cell membrane, I'm going to change its voltage. That's step number five. Number six, there is a name given to that change in voltage. The change in voltage in neuron number two is called the postsynaptic potential. That just means the change in voltage in neuron number two. If, notice for step seven with a red star, if and only if we depolarize, we excite neuron number two enough so that it reaches the magic limit called threshold at the trigger zone, then and only then will neuron number two pop off an action potential. All right, I know this is one of those things. It takes 10 times to go through it before you can tell Uncle Bob about it or me about it on the test. Let's do it one more time together, now just with pictures. And the big picture is this. Please think back to the slide I showed you where I put two neurons together. Remember what this is under high power. This is axon of neuron number one making a connection with the dendrite of neuron number two. Please look back at that picture where I put a red oval around that connection under low power. So here we go. Let's do this together. There's no words on the slide. An action potential, also called a nerve impulse, that high tension electrical spike comes down neuron number one and it reaches some voltage-gated channels shown here in purple that pop open and let calcium flow into the end bulb. That's a signal that causes exocytosis, or spitting out of the neurotransmitter chemical into the cleft. It drifts across the cleft and that chemical binds to receptors on chemical-gated ion channels. That causes those ion channels to pop open and let ions flow through. In this case, this example shows positive sodium flowing into neuron number two. That will change the voltage. There's a name for that. It's called the postsynaptic potential. Then, if and only if, we excite, we depolarize, we make positive enough neuron number two to reach the magic number we call threshold at the trigger zone, then and only then will neuron number two pop off a nerve impulse. While you're digesting that, maybe making some notes, you might be thinking, oh boy, that's really too trivial. I'll remember the seven steps for the test, but I'll never use this in the real world. Well, you will, and I'll give you some examples. All these steps we talked about, and we only did it between two neurons, they take time. You could actually measure the time in fractions of a millisecond. And again, in the nervous system, it's often many neurons hooked together in a chain, So it takes time for this to happen. I'll give you an example where you might have experienced this. My wife, the other day, she said, "Lee, take out the trash." Not that my wife tells me what to do. I'm just using that as an example. And before I realized it, I said to her, "What did you say?" And then a fraction of a second later, I realized I really did hear what she said. In other words, there was this weird kind of delay in processing, right? There's a name for that. It's called a synaptic delay, and we've all experienced that little delay in processing. What about drugs? Let's talk about drugs. If you want to be a multi-bazillionaire of a pharmaceutical company, learn how to manipulate the chemical synapse. And please, if you do figure it out, cut me in 1%. That's all I'm asking. Let's talk about, for example, Botox. How does Botox work? You know, a lot of people, they get wrinkles as they get older. Sometimes that comes from prolonged muscle contraction of muscles in the face that leads to these grooves and wrinkles. So someone said, "Hey, if I relax the muscles, I'll relax the wrinkles and smooth them out." And they came up with a safe form of botulinum A toxin called Botox. And what Botox does is Botox prevents one of the steps that we just talked about. It prevents exocytosis of the neurotransmitter called acetylcholine. So acetylcholine can't land on the muscle. The muscle can't contract. Therefore, it relaxes, and flattens out our wrinkles. What about cocaine? You've heard of young, healthy athletes just dropping dead, either maybe on the football field or the basketball court. And then they do the autopsy and found out they were on cocaine. What's the deal there? Cocaine keeps high concentrations of adrenaline constantly pummeling the next neuron in the chain. And often we're talking about nerves that are eventually connecting to the heart muscle, let's say. And the heart muscle gets repetitively pounded on and stimulated by adrenaline to the point where the heart just can't take it. And the athlete drops dead. What about drugs called SSRIs? You'll study them in pharmacology if you take that course. That stands for selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. You don't have to know that from my course, but the deal is this. Someone figured out that in people who are depressed, they don't have enough of a chemical called serotonin. Serotonin is kind of like a happy chemical. Your brain neurons love to be bathed in serotonin, happy juice. So someone who knew that and who knew the chemical synapse said, "I will invent a drug that maintains a higher concentration of serotonin inside the synaptic cleft and keep it so it will repetitively stimulate the neurons that are in its chain, and so these drugs keep our neurons bathed in the happy juice we know as serotonin." I have another question at the bottom of the slide that's just kind of fascinating. It says, during learning, what happens to dendrites and synapses? And this always fascinated me. Although I think I mentioned earlier in the course, you know, once a neuron's whacked, it don't come back. In general, you know, we don't grow new brain cells. But here's what we can do, and we do. When you learn a new trade or learn a new subject, when you study, physically we are sprouting new dendrites. Physically we are making new synapses. We are actually training our brains, and it's physically growing. And that's how we get good at stuff. This last slide that we're responsible for has to do with more explanation about the term postsynaptic potentials. Remember, in English, all that means is we're talking about the voltage change in neuron number 2. there are two types of postsynaptic potentials, excitatory and inhibitory. Unfortunately, all your book shows is an example of an excitatory postsynaptic potential. That's what we already did. It's called for short an EPSP. Yeah, that's what my friends on the weekends call it. That's what I might call it on the test. What was the EPSP we just talked about? It was caused by an excitatory neurotransmitter which depolarized the postsynaptic neuron, making the inside more positive and therefore the generation of an action potential much more likely. That's why I put a smiley face next to the EPSP. Let's go back to the picture we used. This is an example of an EPSP. Think of these red dots as red hot excitatory neurotransmitter. They popped open the chemical gate. They let positive sodium in. That excited or depolarized neuron number two. If you excite it enough, it'll pop off an action potential. Again, this is an example of an excitatory neurotransmitter and an excitatory postsynaptic potential. But your book could have done it a different way. Let me stay on this picture, then I'll fill in the blanks with you on the next slide. Let's say, for example, we release instead a blue. Pretend these are blue dots, because when people think of blue, if I feel blue, I feel depressed, right? Let's release a blue inhibitory neurotransmitter. Let's make it land on the chemical gate, but now let's let in an anion. Let's say negative chloride flows into neuron number two. I'll change its voltage again, won't I? If I put negative chloride in there, now I will hyperpolarize it, right? Because I made it hypernegative. I made the inside of neuron two more negative. And therefore, I depressed it, didn't I? I made generation of a nerve impulse much less likely. Let's make sure we fill in the blanks together. An IPSP, an inhibitory postsynaptic potential, is caused by an inhibitory neurotransmitter, which hyperpolarizes the postsynaptic neuron, making the inside more negative and generation of a nerve impulse much more difficult. What's the big picture here? I want to try to put this together for you. Our bodies like to be in homeostasis, right? We like to be in balance. And for the purposes of our survey course, it's okay to think of the body like this. As we're sitting wherever we are right now, we're in roughly a 50-50 balance of EPSPs and IPSPs. In other words, half our nerve cells are getting excited and half of them are getting inhibited, or half of them are receiving excitatory signals and half of them receiving inhibitory signals. We're in balance. If we had too much excitation, we'd all be having seizures right now. If we had too much inhibition, we'd all be slumped over in a coma right now. Give you some examples. Have you ever heard of something called a myoclonic jerk? No, that's not the guy who almost hit me in the intersection this morning. A myoclonic jerk is this. Did you ever notice just before you fall asleep, you have that little shake or that little jerk of an arm or a leg? That's called a myoclonic jerk. We think that what that might be due to is a temporary imbalance of the EP and IPSPs. In other words, at that moment, we may have a little bit too much excitation in the balance as opposed to inhibition. So we have that little jerk, that little shake. Almost looks like a mini seizure, doesn't it? What about strychnine poisoning? How does that alter the balance? In the old days, apparently that was one of the ways they used to off people. Strychnine, what it does is it blocks all IPSPs. So the soon-to-be no longer person has full excitation and no inhibition. all their muscles contract at once, one last time, including their diaphragm. What about Valium? How does Valium work? Well, someone knew this physiology and anatomy, and Valium shifts the balance. Valium shifts the balance more towards IPSPs, more towards inhibition. So Valium makes us feel kind of more mellow, more a little bit, you know, more inhibited, more, it kind of chills us out, like a chill pill, right? So Valium shifts the balance. And I'll take it a step further. You might see people come into the ER with seizures, and with this knowledge and this drug called Valium, Valium can be used intravenously to stop seizures in the emergency room. So yes, this is real life stuff. This is an embedded animation. Again, take a look at these and hopefully they're helpful. The very last slide is just for you. There's really no information, no new information here. It's just trying to show you that we're just scratching the surface in this course. Things are much more complicated. I mean, take a look at this slide, but picture instead billions of neurons making trillions of connections and all kind of signals going every which way all at the same time. So it's much more complicated than we're doing. But I think when you really look at this slide, you'll realize how fascinating, once again, the human body is.